Pakistani plane lands in the Kabul airport, the first foreign commercial flight to arrive in Afghanistan since the Taliban's takeover. Hamas says Israeli attacks on Gaza are an attempt by Tel Aviv to divert attention from the escape of Palestinian inmates from its high-security jail. North Korea says it has successfully tested a new long-range cruise missile and hails it as a strategic weapon of great significance. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour, a Pakistani passenger plane has touched down at Kabul airport, and it's become the first foreign commercial flight to arrive in the country since the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. A journalist aboard a flight from Islamabad has been quoted as saying that there was more staff than passengers on the aircraft. A spokesman for the Pakistani airline said that the flight will carry people holding valid travel documents from Kabul. The airport was severely damaged during a chaotic evacuation of more than 120,000 people that ended with the U.S. withdrawal of forces on August 30th. The Taliban have been trying to get it operating again with technical assistance from Qatar and some other countries. Qatar Airways operated several charter flights out of Kabul last week, while an Afghan airline resumed domestic services on September the 3rd. Well, to get a better picture, let's go to Kabul. Amin Alami, our correspondent, is there. Amin, looks like that operations are starting at Kabul airport.
Well, Behrouz, following the collapse of Kabul into the hands of Taliban, the capital Kabul, mainly Kabul International Airport, faced a chaotic situation, mainly due to the evacuation process of tens of thousands of foreign and Afghan nationals from this key airport here in the Afghan capital Kabul. But almost 15 days or more than 3 weeks later, the Pakistani government and Pakistan's international airlines aircraft landed today here in Kabul. It had 10 passengers, according to Taliban sources as well as Pakistani sources. This is the first commercial flight landing in Kabul International Airport after the Taliban's takeover. However, both sources, I mean Pakistanis and Taliban, also say that we are optimistic to continue such flights between Islamabad and Kabul. This comes as the Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid had earlier said that the Taliban government will not allow those Afghan nationals who even have passports or visas to exit from Afghanistan till the second phase of evacuation, according to Zabihullah Mujahid. Given this was the first international commercial flight that was landed here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, the people of Afghanistan, mainly the residents of Kabul, also welcomed the move by Pakistani officials as well as by the Taliban. They are saying that the Taliban need to allow those Afghan nationals and the rest of our nationals who are still inside Afghanistan, they are planning to get out of this country via using international flights. This demand was also highlighted by some top officials of US, UK and some other Western European countries. They are still calling on the Taliban to extend the evacuation process of all foreign nationals and Afghan nationals who are after leaving this country.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Amin Alami in Kabul. The United Nations is convening an aid conference in Geneva on Monday as concerns over a looming humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. UN officials, including Secretary General Antonio Guterres and government representatives, are set to attend the event. The main goal of the meeting is to raise more than $600 million in aid for Afghanistan. The majority of the donated money will be given to the World Food Program and the World Health Organization to offer life-saving assistance. The Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan last month has increased pressure on UN agencies due to an abrupt suspension of foreign donations to Afghanistan. The World Body says that more than 18 million Afghans are facing a humanitarian disaster. Millions more could join them very soon. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that fresh Israeli air raids on Gaza are an attempt by the Tel Aviv regime to divert attention from the successful escape of inmates from its high-security jail. Hamas's spokesman says that response to Israeli airstrikes on Gaza and anger across the West Bank showed a people's support for those behind bars. The spokesman underlined that the regime has been unable to impose its will on the Palestinian nation. Earlier today, Israeli warplanes once again pounded areas across the besieged Palestinian Strip. Israel claims the airstrikes are in response to rockets fired from Gaza. New tensions flared up after six Palestinians escaped the regime's Gilboa prison last week. Now let's cover this over to Gaza City. Ashraf Shannon is there. Ashraf, what's the situation like there in Gaza? And tell us more about the Palestinian faction's reaction.
Well, Behrouz, the overall situation in the Gaza Strip is extremely tense due to the issue of Palestinian prisoners, those who were captured and who are still at large, and also the thousands of prisoners who are being suffering inside Israeli jails. This is all of this is interconnected with the Israeli air raids against the Gaza Strip yesterday, today, and the day before. As Hamas's spokesman Hazem Qasem said in a statement today, that these airstrikes show the frustration of the Israeli regime regarding those six SKPs who managed to flee from Israeli regime's maximum security prison in the occupied northern Palestine, the Gilboa prison. Hazem Qasem said that the resistance factions will do all they can to free all Palestinian prisoners, and he also said that such Israeli attacks will not weaken the Palestinian resistance. We have to also remember that in May of this year, the Israeli regime launched an 11-day war on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming hundreds of innocent Palestinians, including women and children. At least 66 children were killed, while Palestinian factions fired over 4,000 projectiles and rockets towards the Israeli regime. And that situation was started and was ignited by the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound by Israeli settlers and Israeli soldiers. Now the situation of the Palestinian prisoners is the one on the surface right now, and the whole tension inside the occupied Palestinian territories is over the situation of the Palestinian prisoners who are languishing behind Israeli bars, especially the six SKPs four of whom were captured by Israeli forces.
All right. And Ashraf, what about the damage or possible casualties? We didn't receive any reports. The damage and casualties incurring possibly from the recent Israeli airstrikes.
There is, I believe, the reason the Israeli regime forces avoided killing Palestinians over the last few days during their attacks is they hit empty training centers and security posts that belong to Hamas's military wing, the Zayed Qassam brigades, and also mm-hmm. Islamic Jihad's Al-Quds brigades, because they don't want to escalate the situation, because they know very well that if they kill a resistance fighter or kill someone in Gaza through their airstrikes, combined with the situation of the prisoners right now, could force the resistance factions in Gaza to fire hundreds, maybe thousands of projectiles towards the Israeli regime. And Israel right now will not be happy about it, because they're celebrating Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, mm-hmm. and also other holidays in the coming days.
Okay, thank you for that. Ashraf Shannon in Gaza. In the meantime, Israeli forces have demolished a house belonging to a Palestinian family southeast of Tel Aviv. The regime has not cited the reason for destroying the house in the city of Lod. The move is the latest in a series of destructions by Israel in the occupied Palestinian lands recently. The regime uses various pretexts to demolish Palestinian homes and structures on a regular basis. Palestinians and rights groups say that the demolition drive is aimed at grabbing more land for settlement expansion, which is illegal under international law. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in several resolutions in the past. In the meantime, the military wing of Palestinian Resistance Movement Hamas has promised to release the re-arrested Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail on Monday. It has stressed that resistance against the Israeli occupation will go on. Rova Shalat reports.
Abu Ubaida, spokesman for the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, pledged in a speech to release the prisoners who were rearrested after escaping from an Israeli jail on Monday. He also stressed that the rearrest of the prisoners does not hide the extent of shame Israel is going through, as Palestinian inmates have shaken their security system reputation.
No prisoner swap deal will be made without the release of our heroic prisoners who were rearrested by the occupation forces. We promise our inmates that they will be liberated soon within the no swap deal. Our inmates have exposed the fragility of the security of the enemy.
Immediately after Abu Ubaida's speech, Palestinian resistance fired rockets toward the occupied lands to show that they are ready to face the Israeli regime and defend Palestinians. In response, the Israeli airplane launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian resistance has achieved many goals. First, it succeeded in forcing the Israeli regime out of Gaza. Second, it demolished the Zionist thought of having this land for themselves. Israeli violations and attacks against Palestinians will never terrify us.
In conjunction with this, the resistance factions held a national conference stressing the importance of the resistance.
The clashes with this Israeli regime will persist. The regime can never feel secure as long as it steals our rights and kills our people. We will never leave our prisoners alone, and the resistance will set them free.
On Saturday evening, the rearrested prisoners appeared at the Israeli court in the city of Nazareth to extend their detention while being deprived of having a lawyer. Palestinians here stress on supporting the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and considering them the symbol of the Palestinian issue. Palestinian factions believe that the resistance is the only way to get their rights back. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says that a recent agreement between Iran and the agency solved a, quote, major communication breakdown with Tehran. Rafael Grossi said that the agreement will allow the IAEA inspectors to service its monitoring cameras at Iranian nuclear sites. He added that the agreement meant the agency had continuity of knowledge. Grossi, however, said that the agreement was not a permanent solution and was only a stopgag that would buy time for more diplomacy.
Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has made a day-long visit to Tehran. During his short visit, he met with the new head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. The Iranian official hailed the constructive talks he held with the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Speaking at a joint press conference after the meeting, Islami described the negotiations, mainly on technical issues, as constructive and said confidence building is what matters for Tehran and the UN nuclear watchdog.
Today, Mr. Grossi came to Tehran at the invitation of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and we had good and constructive talks. The negotiations were held in a spirit of cooperation to create opportunities for enhanced interactions within the framework of the International Atomic Energy Agency's rules and regulations. Mr. Grossi will visit Tehran again in the near future, and the IAEA's technical team will also come to Iran to make necessary arrangements for the replacement of surveillance camera memory cards in accordance with the safeguards agreement.
But I'm glad to say that today we were able to have a very concrete result, which has to do with the continuity of the operation of the agency's equipment here, which is indispensable for us to provide the necessary guarantees and the information to the IAEA and to the world that everything is in order and that we are going to be able to assist also to assist Iran in its future negotiations in the context of the JCPOA.
Back in February, Iran and the IAEA reached a technical understanding under which Tehran agreed to keep the camera recordings from its nuclear sites for 3 months as a goodwill gesture in support of diplomacy, waiting to see whether the other parties to the JCPOA could manage to bring the U.S. back into full compliance with the deal. The agreements came shortly after Iran decided to stop its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol that allowed the IAEA to carry out short-notice inspections in Iran, denying the agency's inspectors access to the country's nuclear facilities beyond the safeguards agreement. The decision was made in accordance with the December 2020 law passed by the Iranian parliament, dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to Counter Sanctions, that prompted the Iranian administration to restrict the IAEA's inspections and accelerate the development of the country's nuclear program beyond the limits set by the JCPOA. Iranian officials have cautioned the IAEA Board of Governors to avoid miscalculations at its upcoming meeting, warning that taking advantage of the IAEA for political purposes will draw a different response from Tehran. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
In other news, North Korea has test launched a new type of long-range cruise missile, calling it a strategic weapon of great significance. The country's media reported the missile tests were performed successfully on Saturday and Sunday. They flew 1,500 kilometers before hitting targets and falling into the country's territorial waters. Pyongyang says the development of the missiles is an effective deterrence against hostile forces. The U.S. military reacted to the tests, saying that they pose threats to North Korea's neighbors and beyond. Japan has also expressed concerns, saying it will continue to work closely with the U.S. and South Korea to monitor the situation. Talks aimed at dismantling Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missile programs in return for U.S. sanctions relief collapsed in 2019. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. The big, beautiful city of Tehran, though a crowded city, is a perfect place for having tours. Tehran is a city which has both old and modern attractions once in a place. Some of the modern structures and monuments of Tehran are really spectacular. Today we are going to visit one of these eye-catching structures, Abrisham Bridge. Abrisham Bridge, literally Silk Bridge, with the height of 200 meters, connects Banader and Nowruz parks. This bridge is located in Abbasabad Hills in Tehran. Based on the comprehensive plan for Abbasabad lands, the construction of 7 bridges has been pre-planned to be implemented in this area. These bridges have been built for the convenience of the citizens residing there, such as availability of cultural and recreational facilities. Abrisham and Tabiat bridges are part of this plan, and their construction has been completed, and they are operational now. Abrisham Bridge is a cable state bridge with modern architecture. This bridge weighs 130 tons and can tolerate weight of up to 200 tons. Abrisham Bridge construction took about 1.5 years to be completed. I am now standing near Abrisham Bridge. From the distance I'm looking at the bridge, it's so beautiful. I really can't wait to go over the bridge and see this modern structure from a closer view. I am now over the Abrisham Bridge. On my right side, there is Abatash Park, and on my left side, there is Gumbad-e Mina. Well, this bridge is designed for pedestrians, bicycles, and carriages. And this is also a perfect place for photography. Artists and enthusiasts can find amazing subjects for photography in this place. God, Tehran's view from over the Abrisham Bridge is really stunning. Just across from me, mountains of northern Tehran can be seen. These mountains are magnificent and have doubled the beauty of Tehran. The sound of laughing and cheering of people who have come to Abrisham Bridge for having fun is great and full of life. Some youths are busy taking selfies just beside me. I think Abrisham is a really meaningful name for this bridge. The kindness and compassion of the people look like silk. Beautiful, delicate, and strong. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. 20 years have passed since the terrorist attacks on 9/11 in the U.S., and some documents about the investigation of the incident have just been declassified. This after some families of the victims of 9/11 told U.S. President Joe Biden to declassify the documents or not to appear at commemoration ceremonies. Well, the highly redacted documents point to possible involvement by Saudi officials with at least two of the hijackers. What does this say about the Saudis, and what does it say about American officials who have ignored this information for so long? Well, I'd like to start this off with Wyatt Reed, correspondent in Washington. Wyatt, tell us about what's being said about this Saudi connection.
That's right. We have a 16-page report that's been declassified here, not but new, coming out of this, at least of the portions that are simply unreadable, just large blocks of text that are totally blacked out for various reasons. Chief among them being that other U.S. government agencies declined to allow those to be redacted. They said that would somehow jeopardize their operations. So a lot of connections still very unclear. This report focused mainly on two of the hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar. These were men who were sort of the advance guard of the 9/11 hijackings. And they met with a man named Omar al-Bayoumi, who is kind of a very central character in all of this. He serves as essentially a conduit for the al-Qaeda extremists and the Saudi government. Now, the CIA, for example, knew that those two hijackers had met in Kuala Lumpur with Sheikh Khalid Mohammed to plan something. This information, for whatever reason, did not make its way from the CIA to the FBI. They, in fact, allowed the hijackers to enter the country to meet almost immediately with Bayoumi. And, of course, we all know what happened. The FBI, in fact, at the time, chose not to act on that information. They said no action required in internal documentation. So we know at the very CIA, the FBI, not on the same page there. And from in terms of what this document tells us that is new, again, not a lot. So I wouldn't imagine that the families of the victims are terribly thrilled if this is any indication of the kind of declassification that we can go that we can expect going forward. Not a whole lot here.
Right. All right. Well, thanks so much for that update. And of the D.C. Press News correspondent, Wyatt Reed. Now, I'd like to welcome my other guests to the spotlight. Dan Kovalik, international human rights lawyer out of Pittsburgh. And John Bosnich, a journalist and political analyst out of Zurich.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let me start this off with John in Zurich. Right after the attacks, there was already suspicion of Saudi involvement, especially because the majority of hijackers were Saudi. Why do you think that the possible Saudi involvement wasn't really pursued?
Well, this is a pretty obvious piece of information. The Bush family had a very close relationship with the Saudi government, and the U.S. intelligence services already had a very close relationship with the Saudi activists who were being sent into battle in Afghanistan and who were being used in all around the world already by the CIA. So anything that touched upon the Saudi links to Washington would have been taboo and would have been quashed immediately.
What does that mean, John, staying with you? I mean, because of the involvement that Washington had with certain Saudi entities, would the government would be willing to ignore if the Saudi government was actually involved in this terrorist attack?
Well, the entire topic of 9/11 is itself a Pandora's box. I studied engineering. I spent years in engineering before going into journalism, and I can tell you that the entire engineering about the ability of two airplanes by themselves to bring down two buildings is always in question, and there are thousands of engineers in America who have signed petitions saying that it was not possible and it had to have been an inside job. But that's a topic in itself. What we do know is that the CIA was arming and financing terror units from the Saudi regime, and they were sending them around the world wherever they needed them, and they wanted to use them against the Soviet Union. So this was a super sensitive subject. In fact, when I was working in Washington 8 years later, it was still a taboo topic, mm-hmm. which could only be addressed on very, very tender terms.
Okay, I'm going to get back to that Pandora's box that you talked about, John, but let me get Dan in on this discussion. Dan, I mean, if we look at some of these documents that have been reluctantly released and still heavily redacted, what exactly does that mean? On the one hand, to release information, but really not to release the information. And then this 20 years later, what do you think this is all about?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, there is a lawsuit that some of the families of the 9/11 victims have brought against Saudi Arabia. And so I think the government feels some obligation to release information about any Saudi involvement with the 9/11 attacks. But as you say, not enough to really clarify what happened. I mean, the great shame, of course, of all this is that, you know, most of the attackers were from Saudi Arabia. Clearly, Saudi Arabia had some involvement and supported this terrorist attack in some way, certainly ideologically, if in no other way. And how did the U.S. respond to this? It attacked countries that not only had nothing to do with 9/11, but that were actually opposed to Al-Qaeda and groups like that. And so it attacked Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and it attacked Libya and Syria, and has tried to undermine Iran, which actually helped the U.S. after 9/11 fight Al-Qaeda. And so, obviously, the U.S. government knows all this and knows that what the U.S. did in response to 9/11 has absolutely no justification, never had any justification. And so they've waited as long as possible to release documents, and I have a feeling we'll never know the full truth of what happened on 9/11, but we know enough. Again, we know that the perpetrators were not the countries that have been attacked, and truthfully, that should be enough to know that this thing has been mishandled in a hugely criminal way.
Well, John, you talked about that Pandora's box earlier. Now Dan said what we do know is that the countries that were attacked were not involved. We know no Afghani was on the was a hijacker, nor Iraqi. But these two countries were immediately, especially Afghanistan, of course, right away it was invaded, and then Iraq. So what does this mean? Was this whole thing planned, and planned by whom, to actually be able to start this war on terror? I mean, where do we start here? We go with the chicken or the egg. I mean, you go. Just go ahead, John. Let me hear what you have to say about this.
I can tell you that we do have factual evidence that the United States has had a hit list since the late 1970s of countries and governments around the world that they wanted to remove. However, given the fact that there is modern media and there is a reporting base that can report what the U.S. government is up to, there had to be a really big excuse to make war on these countries. You can't just do what they used to do hundreds of years ago, just declare war on a country for the interests of your nation. So there had to be a trigger. And this event, the 9/11 attack, was too convenient for anybody who works in the field in which I've been working. I've worked as a war reporter, I have experience in engineering and structural engineering, and I've worked as a government advisor. And I can tell you that this particular incident matches the criteria exactly for what was planned, and that was knockout strikes against several, in one case they said it was up to seven countries that were going to be knocked out and have their governments replaced by pro-American regimes. And we know that the events at 9/11 were quickly followed up with these kinds of wars. So I would suggest that there's still if I had to say my opinion about 9/11, my opinion is that the event was staged with the knowledge of the U.S. government and with the participation of the Saudi government, which benefited from the wars that have been made against Saudi enemies or threatening nations near to the Saudi kingdom.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned the word benefited, John, and let me get Dan in on this, because it, like with any crime situation, the first thing one asks is, who benefited? Which country benefited from the situation that happened on 9/11 and, of course, the war on terror following it? What would you say? How would you answer that question, Dan?
Yes, I mean, first of all, I think the primary group that benefited was not any particular nation, but it was defense contractors. I mean, they made out like gangsters, literally, like gangsters. You know, getting trillions of dollars from U.S. taxpayers for wars that have gone on now for 20 years and that will continue to go on in one form or another because, of course, every war brought upon the region more conflict, right? Libya was really the classic case, you know, that has destabilized all of northern Africa. The Iraq war destabilized that part of the world. The intervention in Syria has destabilized not only Syria, but Lebanon. And so that sort of instability, it's hard for me to say that any particular country benefited very much at all, because every country has reaped a certain whirlwind from these terrible events. But again, the defense industry, they've done wonderfully. And they are happy, and their shareholders are happy, and that's really who benefited. I just want to add one thing. You know, it's clear that, you know, as was said, that the U.S. was planning to go after these some of these countries, including Afghanistan, even before the 9/11 attacks. It's also clear that, for example, the CIA and George Tenet, the head of the CIA at the time, knew that something like this was going to happen, did not tell the FBI, did not tell other parts of the government that could have stopped it. They wanted a Pearl Harbor. That's not to say, you know, that I side with those who think that the U.S. government actually created that Pearl Harbor, but I think there's some good evidence that there were actors who allowed it to go happen as a justification for these wars, which again have benefited the military-industrial complex.
Well, John, let me open that Pandora's box a little bit more now. I want to talk about the possibility, because we're looking at which entities could have benefited now. Dan talked about the wars that have taken place and the destabilization, for example, talking about Syria and Lebanon. With that being said, there are some actual analysts who say that they feel that actually Israel was one of the biggest beneficiaries in 9/11. Your take on that?
Absolutely. I want to underline that I agree with your other guest when he said it may not be the country that benefits. And in fact, definitely the country of America did not benefit by going to war all over the world. And this is a standard mistake that people think. People think around the world that when America goes to war, it's because the interests of America are at stake. That's not the case. If you review the recent wars that America has been involved with, these are wars which serve the military-industrial complex first. And these are beyond windfall profits. These are unlimited amounts of money flowing from the taxpayer to the military-industrial complex. And I want to tie these things together. The fact that there was a hit list meant that there needed to be a spark to start the militarism, to start the wars off. But then there was also the added component of the fake color revolutions, which were used to launch regime change in other countries. So it was a two-fist approach. We will respond to the evil countries who attacked us, which were not the countries in any way involved in the attack. And at the same time, other countries were being destabilized and big riots were being coordinated by the CIA. So this full court push by the CIA, and it came after a 15-year period in which the target country was publicly listed and publicly known. So there is here for the tower bombings to have been a single unrelated event. The softest thing I can say is that perhaps, I doubt it, but perhaps the CIA found out that this group of Saudis was going to make the attack, and once they found out about it, they did not inform the government. They allowed the attack to go forward. They made sure it took place and then used it as a disaster on which they could justify making war. The other extreme is that the government was involved, not at the peak. Normally, the secret deep state operates around the president, without informing the president so the president can maintain deniability. There have been several academic research papers done about Pearl Harbor, about the Gulf of Tonkin, and definitely 9/11 has to be added to the list of events that most likely were known of or rigged and used as an excuse by the U.S. military-industrial complex to make wars and to take money basically directly from the U.S. taxpayers' pocket. And you asked me about Israel. There is no greater lobby in Washington than the Israel lobby. A man named John Mearsheimer wrote an excellent book on the topic called The Israel Lobby, and if any one country benefited as a country from the aftermath of 9/11, it was Israel. Because as soon as 9/11 was staged or conducted by whichever group conspired to do it, Israel was the first country to say, see, this is what we're up against. Now you have to join us in our wars. And America did. Thousands of Americans died. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of others died. And trillions of dollars were sunk into the military-industrial complex. That's the entire scenario.
Well, Dan, what does it leave the United States right now? As John said, obviously the American people did not benefit from 9/11. And if we look at where it started, of course, in Afghanistan, and 20 years later, of course, the Taliban is back in control in Afghanistan. And so all of this money, all the excuses they used in their war on terror, basically they haven't gotten a lot. But again, are we just going to talk about the U.S. government and the American people? Or was all of this done for the military-industrial complex?
Well, I think it largely was done for that. I mean, I do think that there was a grander strategy of trying to remake the Middle East, West Asia, and you know, parts of Northern Africa, to remake them into places that were seen as more hospitable to U.S. economic interest and to Israeli expansion. I think that was part of the goal, but in the end, I don't think that largely succeeded. I think the U.S. probably has now lost the Middle East forever, has no credibility in that part of the world or much of the part of the world. Most people in the world understand that what the U.S. did after 9/11 was a crime, and it was worse, much worse than the crime they were responding to. And I think in the end, certainly the American people have suffered greatly, not from, to an extent from 9/11, of course. There was a huge death toll from that. But the American people have suffered much greater from the U.S. reaction to it. Again, the trillions of dollars that went into this war have not benefited the American people. The U.S. infrastructure is in decline. It's ruined. In large part, we see this, you know, with how these floods are being handled in places like New York City, which should have been, redesigning its infrastructure years ago in anticipation of this. We see this in the COVID numbers, which are still the worst in the world. The U.S. is basically a third world country now, and the 9/11 wars helped bring that about. And
okay,
again,
I'm out of town, Dan. I'm out of time, Dan. But John, is this the end to the American empire?
Well, it is the biggest step in that direction. And the fact is that with so much of that report still blocked out, if the truth were ever released to the American public, it would be the American public that would pull down their own empire from the inside.
Okay, and on that note, so sorry, we are out of time. Appreciate both of you being with us. Out of Pittsburgh, Dan Kovalik, international human rights lawyer, and out of Zurich, journalist and political analyst, John Busnich. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio. I'm Atal, the host of this program. This series of Viewpoints is concerned with the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Sadiq. Sheikh Sadiq, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum, very happy to be with you.
You're welcome, brother. And Sheikh Qasim, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, in a series of the programs of Viewpoints regarding the speeches and the thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, today we want to talk about the important concept of safety, or it could be also roughly translated as security, and also calmness and tranquility inside, which these two terms or these two concepts are usually juxtaposed, come together. You know, just look at the way that the nature is waking us up every morning. Mm. And just look at the rain, look at the trees, look at even the animals, brother, okay? Yeah. Look at what are the animals, you know, are doing in the very early morning. SubhanAllah, when you look at them, they are thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They are very much thankful to the very much creator. So if you ask the world, and if you listen to the voices, I think, because we are not listening nowadays, okay? If you listen to the world, you can see that they find their own true source. Yeah. And they know that they're going to. But unfortunately, this rationality, this intellect that the human beings is benefited with is getting us away and away. And every day, although there are many innovations, there are many novelties, there are many, new discoveries around, but the people in the world are day by day away from the security and peace inside. They cannot find peace anywhere. They commit suicide, they take pills, they take this and that. They take tranquilizers, okay, as the pills. They cannot fight it. And unfortunately, I think this is because they are day by day away from the fitra. Isn't it, Sheikh Sadiq? What's your comment on that?
Yeah, we could say it's being away from the meaning. Mm-hmm. Especially when you think about suicide.
Yes.
When you don't have, like, sometimes it's because of, like, severe problems.
Yeah.
Put that away. But people who just don't find meaning, like, why should I go on?
That's right.
Why should I go on? What does it mean? If it doesn't mean anything, I don't want to continue. Mm-hmm. So that could be one of the biggest motivations for suicide.
That's right.
And the problem with that is, the reason for that is, the true meaning of life is infinity, is becoming infinite, is realizing, actualizing your potential, which is infinite.
That's right.
Getting close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in other words. And when everything that you learn when you're brought up is your life is limited to the time when you're born and when you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Your bodily, physical,
yes.
material life. That's it. Of course, that doesn't have any meaning.
Expectations, brother. The expectations that are made for the people nowadays in the world. They are surrounded by the expectations which cannot be fulfilled and achieved. Buying the car, buying the house, having this, having that.
Yeah,
okay?
That is a source of anxiety.
Yeah, is a source of anxiety. And day by day, you cannot reach that. You are getting away.
Yeah.
You deceive this one. You trick that one. You make a trap with that. You got, you know, you have to get a big loan with much higher rate of interest in order to buy this, in order to buy that. And you make yourself indebted to the world around yourself. And just one day, after 30, 40 years of life, you look around and you see what you have. You do not have peace inside. So this materialistic mundane life would not bring tranquility and security for you. Then I miss the money. I miss my house. What should I do? I should go, I call it, to artificial security and peace. What is that? Insurance companies. You got to get to the insurance companies. You got to this bank, to that institute, to this judicial system, to that judicial system. Please help me. I want to have my tranquility and peace back. I want to have my checks secured. Okay, they have secured, isn't there? They're securing your bank checks, okay? This is not a type of security or justice, or it's better to say tranquility.
I just got a business idea. We can create a insurance company and call it Tawakkul. That would be the ultimate irony.
Yeah, bro. Yeah, it's better to say, yeah, insurance company with the name of Tawakkul, trust in Allah. The case is that sometimes the Muslims, I mean, do their obligations, do their salat, you know, take fast, do this, do that. But still, they do not reach that type of peace inside. What's the problem?
Well, we're too concerned and focused on the appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're hungry, and I give you a cooking book, right?
Okay.
A book of recipes.
Yes.
And you go and read the recipes 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And repeat them, and repeat them, and repeat them. Cake, cake, cake.
Okay.
Does that fill your stomach?
No.
It doesn't satisfy your hunger,
no.
Does it? It's the same with the religion. It's not about repeating the words or repeating the actions. These are pointers to a goal. We have to be concerned with the underlying meaning.
That's right.
And that's why we have Hudur Qalb.
Yes, the presence of the heart.
We hear it, we repeat it, but we don't work for it.
Oh.
Seriously, right?
That's right.
So, no wonder that we still have anxiety and depression and everything else among the religious communities as well.
That's why we have it among the people. Okay, Sheikh Qasem, so what's your comment on that, brother? Why do you think that some people who are even religious, they cannot find tranquility and peace inside?
Yeah. I think the problem is that even though that we believe that deep down we believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is not the case, you know, this is not the case in reality. So in a way, our world, our